we need to start using microphone
because we have some colleagues online.
Okay, well, hi to the colleagues online.
It's not easy because this morning we are in several meetings.
Yeah, I know, I saw that like coming in here, yeah. What we'll do, we'll go and then we'll have the plenaries, I mean, basically, as I called it a few weeks ago, Operation Reboot. Well, the most important element of Reboot is to be able to have all of your meetings, mm-hmm. in whatever fashion we organize them. And until now, we were not able to have our plenary sessions. Mm-hmm. So we had to, let's say we had to replace them by standing committee. And as you know, standing committee is only, in this case, is both of you, head of delegation and the committee chairs. But you leave out a lot of members being able to vote, although they could participate because we called it enlarged. And so now, as from January, we will have all of our plenary sessions, be it physically if possible, physically with remote connection if needed. And if situation calls for it, even we can do it full-fledged remotely. So, fine. I mean, we modified the rules recently, as you know. So, that's fine. So we will have our four plenaries next year. We will have our two or three standing committees in between. Our committees can function. I suppose they function quite well, the way I see it. The quorum issue that we discussed briefly is being adapted to 25%.
It was very important for the quorum.
Yeah.
The 20 meeting, yesterday meeting. If we have the old quorum, 29, we can...
Yesterday we had a social committee meeting, and for the quorum it was very important to reduce to 20 to the number of the quorum. Yes, yeah, it's not too much, but very. Yes.
If we add now the standing committee of next Friday and the three reports we've got on the agenda, because there's one who the rapporteur asked us to put it in February or something, we will have done more than normally scheduled. So let's say that our output is higher than it was before. I'm not speaking about equality, okay? It is different. And the reason why it is higher, it is because in addition to the normal work, if I may say so, we had the whole COVID effort being done on top of it and the whole rules change. But so basically what has come in on top of what we basically set out to do, on top of it we had the COVID, we had the rules changes, and we had the artificial intelligence effort going into a thematic direction. And so we're going to continue with that in coming January. We've got the independence of the justice, the judicial, in January. That's one that we have. We've got the joint procedure, mm-hmm. who now is on the agenda on Wednesday. And we've got the big debate on vaccination programs. I mean, the equality in terms of vaccine provision. So that is important. Okay.
And three auditions, one for example for the Ethical Council of Germany mm-hmm. state. It was very important because she gave us a very complex and complete plan to the vaccination in according to the ethical and right principles of constitutional principles. It was a very interesting debate.
Good.
About ethic questions, practical questions, and we heard some experts associated to the conditions to produce the vaccines.
Okay.
And we discussed about communicated plans for the different states.
That's very interesting.
Out these mics have to use them, huh? That's interesting. But I guess that Germany is more or less ready. I mean, I hear they've got like big vaccination plots and whatever. We'll see.
Yeah,
UK announced they will launch it today.
Yeah, well, they approved their first Pfizer vaccine, right? Well, let's hope it rolls out, because the moment, I mean, the more people are vaccinated, the easier life will get, right? My guess is that we can return what is normal, right? To the new phase of living together by summer. That'll be it, I think. But of course, as far as we are concerned, I mean, I hope, I don't know whether that's even possible, but it wouldn't be bad if members of parliament would be vaccinated in order to do their job in a regular way. But of course, in public opinion, that'll pass difficult, you know, say, well, why would the members of parliament have priority over us? And that'll be a difficult debate. I don't know whether it's possible. I hope so. But we might even consider, I mean, if, I didn't even think about that, lady, but why don't we set up a vaccine scheme at the Council of Europe? I mean, all members coming to the meeting, they get vaccinated, they'll all be there then. That would be a good idea. Why not? I mean, the Brits have got a vaccine registered. The Russians have their vaccine ready. Belgium is close to. I think if we would ask the Russians that, why don't you come and vaccinate everyone, they'll do it immediately. But we just don't know what it'll be. Huh?
Yes,
Mr. Davis, Mr. Vladimir presented the Russian vaccines,
yeah.
The state of the art of the, but he didn't anything about the question, but he want to explain us how Russian developed a very important vaccine for the future. Yes. Yes.
And this is something that we tend to forget, is that we know that Russia is one of the countries with the best reputation in terms of vaccines production. It is true. Of course, the reputation is always there, fortunately, but it is true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that I'm going to head out and ask Tolstoy to say, Peter, come on, ship us. I'm not going to do that. But why not? It's not so silly as an idea, maybe to... But I don't know where it's possible. But I would love to do that. I mean, if you have international organizations, logic would be that it's not a question of priority, but it's a question of being able to function in an international context. It makes sense. But whether politically it flies, that's a different story. And so Portugal, you're going to have elections next year for the president?
Yes, we have the presidential elections in January, 24 January. Probably the president in charge will try the re-election. There is no any doubt about that, but he has not until now said if we'll do it or not.
It keeps the suspense a bit, right? I'll ask him this afternoon when I see him, say, come on, tell me. It's the secret between the two of us.
And by the end of the year, September, October, we will have local elections, we hope, in normal circumstances. But this will be very strange without public physical meetings. It's hard, mainly for the others, not
sure.
For the head of the Republic, who is every day in the television.
Yeah, you cannot open any screen, or he's there
doing a sound campaign.
Not campaigning because he's not yet a candidate. I think that's more or less what it's
yeah.
about. And are there any serious contestants to the president's potential candidacy?
No, it's from the socialist field. We have only one candidate, but the Socialist Party has not a candidate. abstained from giving any kind of orientation.
Okay, they don't want
so
the public against you.
The party is divided
okay.
about that. So the probability of the re-election is very, very high. And the polls confirm this perspective.
Okay.
Which are your main matters regarding the next months of the activity of the Parliamentary Assembly? We will have elections, we have the plenary session in January, but which topics are more relevant from your point of view?
So we from the beginning, what we set out to do is we, from the very start, that was like not knowing that we would have, of course, this a bit difficult situation, is that we set out with basically a number of elements. One of them was the accession of the European Union to the European Convention, which Germany has taken over as a priority now. We'll see where we get. In the coming weeks, I will try to reach out to the European Parliament, Mr. Sassoli, chair of the Speaker of the European Parliament. Although what Parliament to Parliament should have been done, is what they tell me, but still it's like 10 years old, because this whole process has been halted for like a decade. So it's very good that the German presidency takes it up again. From our side, I think that we will head out to Sassoli and say, okay, provided that what we have agreed upon or what was already done 10 years ago, if it doesn't change, why don't we renew it, just to be ready? Of course, then we'll see what happens on the intergovernmental side, because, yeah, there are some aspects, and then, of course, on the court side. Just basically what happens, it's a bit of a turf war, you know, like Luxembourg and Strasbourg. I mean, once the European Union accedes to the convention, basically everything that falls under the convention is under the competences of the court in Strasbourg. Right? But then you have this Charter of the European Union, which also covers human rights and what have you, rule of law specifically. Mm-hmm. Difficult one. So that's one. I hope that goes fast, because the problem that you have now is twice-fold. It's on the one hand, you've got members of citizens of the European Union, such as we are. Basically, we are less protected than all the other ones, because certain competences sit on the European Union level, and there's no court for us, except by exception Luxembourg. So that is very important. And secondly, if you want to avoid the European Union to start to develop their own way of looking at human rights and rule of law, they have to be in the convention. Because before you know it, you've got two ways, and the one or the other wanting to be the champion to the other one, that would be bad. Because then you would have, like, before you know it, at least in the perception, you would get into a dual standard type of situation. Where we are a bit now. If you look at the rulings of Luxembourg, it's a bit that. So that's number one. I think that is essential for the future of both European Union and Council of Europe, each on their field. Second one, obviously, is going to be the Istanbul Convention. This is the one that I'm putting on the agenda constantly, because we see that in certain countries, there is like a tendency of trying to a little bit get away from it. That in the Istanbul Convention sits an article, it's Article 3, right, concerning sex, gender equality. Although in the same article it said gender equality within the context of tradition and culture and what have you, so normally it shouldn't be a problem, but it is taken on board by, let's say, conservative forces who want to get away from it. And they take it on as a political argument in the public debate in order to attract people. I mean, that's a little bit what is happening, so that's a big concern. And so instead of risking that the field of the Istanbul Convention and what it's all about, it is basically fighting violence against women, right? But in order to avoid that the field of action is shrinking, I would like to see it enlarged. So that is a very big point of attention that I have, and I go out trying to have countries who are not yet on board to have them on board. We need a counter movement, right? At least to balance it out, and who knows, even to go further. And then the third one, obviously, as far as I'm concerned, is the is this link between environment and human rights. If you look at the European Convention, and even if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the word environment isn't even in there. I mean, this is 2020, right? We're not 1948 or 1950 or 49. I mean, this is 17 years ago, 70, and still in seven decades, the aspect of environment as being linked to human rights is now not even in there. Which is, by the way, why next week, provided everything goes well, I'll be in New York to have a meeting with Mr. Guterres, a Portuguese citizen, to discuss it. And I absolutely want to have the assembly, and this is what we try to do in April, to renew the recommendation that we set out in 2009 already, requiring, asking, pushing the Committee of Ministers to start working on a protocol to the convention which would introduce environment into the convention. So protocol, as you know, is like an amendment, like a new article, what have you, where indeed in the convention itself, environment would be considered as being a human right. To be debated, and this is not our turf, we can provide for the substance, obviously, but then it is the Committee of Ministers who needs to give the green light for the CCDH or whatever it's called, that committee, to start working on it. And they're working on it already. Although it in the context of a set of non-binding rules, but that's not enough for me. I mean, if you want to capture the intergenerational concerns with all these young people in the street, we need to tackle it forcefully. UN is very interested in it, because of course the UN level is only guidance and good practices and what have you, whereas we set out binding standards. I mean, if at the end of the day we would be successful in having environment in the convention, well, if then some government doesn't do what they should do, a citizen could go to court. Today they can, but they can on the national level. But once that is done, I mean, there's no, let's say, that last resort appeal that the Strasbourg court isn't there yet on that issue. So that to me is paramount. And I'm not a green activist. I'm a Belgian liberal. I don't know where that would sit in the Portuguese political spectrum. I haven't got a clue. I'm far from being a Green Party activist or radicalist. But I do believe, seeing it with my two daughters, the oldest one being 22, the youngest being 14, all these young people, even people of our age, let's say the new 40s, because that's, I always say 60 is the new 40, so more or less that. It is becoming an issue. It has been an issue already for 20, 30, 40 years. Look at the Rome Agreement. That was 1950. That's 70 years ago, that the Rome Agreement basically said we have to stop abusing of the limited resources that we have on the planet. I mean, and we didn't do anything about it, or not enough at least. So that's the third priority as far as I'm concerned, out of the presidency. Now, having said this, of course, we've got the committees and who add priorities to that. But by experience, I know that if you've got too many priorities, you don't do anything. So if we already would be able to have those three, to push from our side for the EU accession, to keep the Istanbul Convention gender equality on the table, forcefully more than yesterday, and introduce the new element of environment and human rights, that's a lot. And then you will have the presidencies like the German one, who will take the artificial intelligence on board. They're working very hard on that. We provided with the substance already, basically meaning that now already the work is being done in the committees on their level to have a set of standards. On environment, if I got it well, they are close to renewing the criminal law environmental convention, which exists, but it's never put into practice. I asked that already for 6 months ago to the Greek presidency. It came over to the German one. So I think that maybe by the end of 2021, if all goes well, We might have a renewed convention on criminal law in environmental cases. That will be good. It's just, it's a piece. We might have a start, if not already a conclusion, of non-binding standards concerning environment and human rights, which would be like a step up to a protocol. And if at the same time we can keep the Istanbul Convention on the table, that would be important. And then in the side, it would have probably, maybe already, big advancement in terms of artificial intelligence. And one other one that I have in my in mind, but we first have to work on these ones, is this new generation of rights that they say. I mean, artificial intelligence is one, environment, but there's another one who is becoming more and more important, in my view, which is what I call the right to know. Sounds a bit bizarre, but today, what is true and what is a lie? I mean, we don't know anymore. If you look at the United States, you're seeing two societies now in the United States, and it's happening also in our countries, in Portugal as well as in Belgium. You've got people only listening to one truth, and you've got then a whole set of the country listening to another type of truth, and maybe a third one, and so they're not joining. You no longer have a vision of everything. It's like parallel truths. And so the right to know the truth
President Obama, important. In a very recent interview, I read in the Expresso a translation this weekend, speaks exactly about that. He says the problem is that we have not a common underground for talking or exchanging views, because there are parallel universes who are unable to link. This is really a very serious problem, but we have some, we can feed some hope regarding the last developments in the domestic politics in the United States. Regarding, well, it depends on the Senate also, but really the problems of the climate changes, we hope can have a different approach from the new presidency.
Important effort being made there, right? Because whether we like it or not, U.S. politics have a big influence on us. That's true. So, yeah, with having Mr. Kerry as a special envoy on climate and other issues, getting back into the Paris Accord, right. But as far as the issue of the right to know, if you look at what is happening in the States, is that this is a very personal opinion, right? But the right to know becomes a commercial item. So take the example of Fox News. I mean, you probably follow it. Now, Fox News, at a certain point in time, like 2 weeks ago, started to be a little bit more objective in our view. I'm not saying that CNN is 100% objective, because they're not. Neither is MSNBC, neither is ABC, but Fox, of course, is far away from. And so you saw them like heading out a little bit and saying, okay, these are the facts. We're just going to inform our viewers of the facts, nothing else but that. Then you had this, the president of today, lashing out to Fox, and they went down in viewers dramatically. And 2 days ago, you had the president back on Fox News telling whatever crazy stuff, and the reporter, a lady reporter, saying, yeah, it's a scandal, and you're right. What does it mean? It means that they want to get their viewers back. So the right to know becomes a commercial item in terms of viewers, which translates itself in terms of value of publicity and what have you on these. That's the big thing. How do you solve that?
It demands regulation.
How are you going to regulate that?
Yeah.
Who is the one who will determine what is true and what is false? Wow.
It's a theological question.
Yes and no, because if you look at it from a democratic point of view, you might say, yeah, but the majority is right. Hello? Is the majority in the states, like for example the Republican majority under the influence of a certain person, are they right? I've got difficulty of finding a way. How do you do that? How to start with what is true and what is false already? I mean, broadly speaking, I mean, I suppose you can limit it to certain, within certain boundaries, but even, wow. That's a big debate, but that's a, I'm not going to start on that one. I first like to have environment done, because if I start on that one, wow, it'll blow up in a positive way. Just look in our own assembly, the whole debate on double standards. Do we want to start on that debate? I'm doing it. You would be surprised which countries would be treated with double standards and which would be, let's say, treated too kindly in terms of double standards. You would be surprised. I mean, all democracies such as ours, they are considered not needed to be under monitoring, right? And all the newcomers, they should stay in monitoring. If from a neutral point of view you would make an analysis, I would dare to take a bet with both of you that probably some European countries should be in monitoring. We put Poland in there, and maybe some other ones, they don't no longer belong in monitoring, right? So just one example. It's wow. But this is why we are there, of course. Migration, other, I mean, what is true and false in terms of migration? Jesus, incredible. Very difficult debate. Sorry, if you have me talking, Chair, I mean, I go.
Mr. President, our colleague, Paulo Pisco, Mr. Paulo Pisco, is Member of Parliament, and he asked the floor to put some question.
Thank you.
Is it possible, technically?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Good morning to everyone. It's a pleasure to have you here to have this possibility of to change some matters. Otherwise, probably it would not be so easy. But there are some questions, some observations that I'd like to share with you, and to hear from you what you think about this. Of course, we have been working in our meetings. Today I had also a meeting of the Migration Committee. What I feel is not that we are not having the same productivity, the same efficacy in our meetings. And I think that in a certain sense, the possibility of to have strong results are being weakened with this dimension of doing everything by digital means. So I'd like to ask you, how do you evaluate this period where we are only working and meeting via Zoom or Kudo or whatever? And if it's not weakening the discussions, the possibility if we go further in our reports, in our decisions, in our perceptions of the reality that we are dealing with, this is in an internal dimension. But there is also an external dimension where the Council of Europe probably, I guess, is not being so present in many of the missions that we used to have to be part of the discussions on many subjects that are fundamental to the human rights and to fairness and other values that are important to us. We are losing also a little bit our strengths. Finally, another question that I would like to put you is, you talked about the subjects that are in your priorities. One of the subjects that I think that we should discuss more deeply is the political extremism within our societies, not Islamic extremism or the terrorism, but the political extremism that are affecting our societies with also with the use of massive use of the social networks, which is a problem. We have already been having some discussions on these issues, but I guess probably we should go further, because as we very often see in the press, this is being a kind of threat to our democracies. So thank you for being here. These are the questions that I would like to put to you, and these remarks and observations. I'm very keen to hear from you. Thank you.
Three elements: one, productivity and way of working through digital means, committees and other ones. The other one refers, if I get it right, as to the presence in the field. And the third one is like how do you go about with the more and more being extreme of positions being taken in the political field, and obviously the effect on the citizen. How do I judge the productivity of the digital committee meetings? I judge them as to the volume. I'm careful. That's okay, because we, as I said in the beginning, we are basically, our output is more than expected in a normal year. So we're doing more, but people are getting tired of it, because you must know yourself, and I know it myself most certainly, strangely enough, it is more tiring having a meeting through video than having a meeting being in the meeting itself. It is something that I didn't know, because we were used to before, I mean, you had like a video conference for half an hour, maybe sometimes an hour, okay? But now suddenly we see that it is more tiring to be attentive on board in a video meeting as compared to being on board in a physical meeting. There's a number of reasons for that. And when you say it is more fatiguing, because tiring is, can be understood in a different way, it also means that it must have an effect on the quality of the work. So undoubtedly, whereas you can have so many more meetings consecutively through video and you can have more output, there is a big question mark as to what is to the substance the result of it. Just putting the question mark. What happens also is that when you have video meetings, now suddenly you're able to do more meetings. Why is that? Because you don't have to go from point A to point B, strangely enough. When we have a meeting in Strasbourg or in Paris, what have you, you head out. I mean, you've got travel time, you're in the meeting, you head back. So the let's say the number of hours that you are working is a lot less than the number of hours that you're working in a video conference. It's very strange if you look at it from, I mean, I'm a commercial engineer, so I'm used to systemized, if you wish, techniques, right, and systems, that's my trade. And if you look at it from that point of view, it is a bit, how would I say, the productivity goes up, but the quality goes down, and the productivity goes up because of the number of hours that you're able to meet, because it's just more. A secondary effect is, and you will have it also, is that what we see, and doubtfully our committee chairs like Lewis see it, now you've got colleagues on board, you yourself. What happens is that you're on the screen. Now, if you would be now in the parliament here, I don't know where you are at, but suddenly you get like a WhatsApp or a text saying, hey, colleague, don't forget, you have to vote in 2 minutes. Up, and you're out, and you have to go vote, you're out of the meeting, you come back into the meeting. Ola, I don't know, where do we stand? Tiring, right? And now we see that, whereas working for the Council of Europe in a committee is like a single task unit type of thing, it becomes multitasking. We see that a lot. And that is what you see, Louis, in your committee means you've got 35 people logged in, and then you have a vote, and then you have to cry out, Ola, I need 20, where are the other ones? Well, they're either in the plenary in their parliament, or they're doing something else, or whatever. So that is a big, big risk as to the, let's say, the output. And we need to cope with that. What does it mean? I've been thinking about that. Well, first of all, it means that from the moment we don't have to meet through video, we won't do it anymore. So this is something that I have to put in the minds and the heads of all of our colleagues in the Council of Europe, is that this is an exceptional situation. It calls for temporary exceptional means of work. Once the exceptional situation is no longer there, we're talking after COVID, we return to physical meetings and that's it. And we do not keep the video meetings on board, except that is possible if you've got webinars, if in a committee you would have like sessions where you've got experts, hearings. Yeah, why is that? Because there you could gain a lot of, let's say, efficiency, because people coming to you to share their expertise, they don't have to travel. I mean, the timing is a lot easier. Yeah, so that's the, but the real work of the committee, I mean, you know, probably the so-called Stockholm syndrome, right? I mean, we need that in order to be in the bubble to do your work. So that's number one. So we've got an enormous expertise now in terms of meeting through video, but we will not keep it for regular work. We will keep it for, let's say, hearings, webinars, and all that. The informative issue, yes, the deliberative, the decision issues, no, as far as I am concerned. And that means, yeah, people need to head out back to Strasbourg, to Paris, to Berlin, wherever you, I mean, committees can be held wherever through Europe. Second issue, if you're not in the field, here we go again, the right to know, it is so different if you're not in the field to know what is exactly happening. You know that little kids game, you've done it, we've all done it when in primary school. I mean, the teacher would put us in a line, 10 next to each other, he would say something in the ear of the first one, and then that person or young, that child would say it in the ear of the second one, the third one, and then the 10th one, the end of the row, what this young person is saying is completely different from what the teacher said in the ear of the first one. What does it mean if you're not in the field and you don't see it and hear it with your own eyes and with your own ears? You'll hear it from someone else, so it'll be modified. And the further away, the more it gets modified. And so that is a big issue in terms of working for the Council of Europe, because you need to have reliable information and reliable data, which we don't. We have it to a certain extent, but that distance is really a problem. It is a problem in terms of monitoring, obviously, because if you'd have to do monitoring from a distance, it's almost impossible. Observation of elections, even worse. If you're not there, impossible. But also for reports, same thing. If you cannot have rapporteurs heading out to the field and looking into the issue at hand, the result is different. So in that sense, it is surely so that we need to be back into the field. Once possible, we'll do it. The third element is the interaction between members of parliament. You know that, I know that. If I have a CUDO meeting, and I'm presiding over a CUDO meeting, I don't see you. I just see the person who is speaking. I don't see any body language. I don't see how people are reacting to certain interventions. I don't see or feel what is the mood of the meeting. You cannot, it's not that you want to steer a meeting, chairing it, but you do want to take into account what is happening in the meeting, right? This is impossible through CUDO. You've got other, you've got other systems like Zoom and BlueJeans, but that's very difficult because at the end of the day, you only have a limited number of persons on your screen. But it's a little bit better, but okay, we now took CUDO. As a matter of fact, CUDO is an easy one for the chairman. You just don't give the floor to anyone, and no one knows that it was even there. it's incredible. I mean, if you want to have a dictatorship as a chairman, that's easy to do. You just don't give the floor. That's it. So, and aside of that, the interaction of members of parliament where you convince a colleague or you allow to be convinced by a colleague, that is essential to parliamentary work. That's no longer there. I mean, just look at meetings, and the committee chairs know that, and certainly also national delegation. In a meeting, the meeting moves, right? And then you've got people who, okay, you convinced me, or let me convince you. That's not possible through video. It doesn't work. And so that is essential to parliamentary dialogue, if you want to use that word. And so that is lost also, because you've got these naked arguments, And you don't have any counter arguments. What you see in these meetings very often is that I will give you the floor and you will say, listen, in my opinion, A, B, C. And then you will have a colleague who speaks after you will say, well, to my dear colleague who said A, B, C, I say X, Y, Z. But in order for you to respond to that again, it's almost impossible in the meeting. So the dynamics are not what they should be. Which is why, again, these are all the arguments why, as a president, I'm trying to have so many as soon as possible, as many as possible people being there. Mind you, it does create a bit of a double standard, because those in the meeting physically will have an advantage as those who are not. But let that be a motivation for those to come into the meeting. Last of all, political extremism. It is linked to what I just said, the right to know. To me, it's a link between the two. Because extremism is built on basically the two main and strongest feelings with any citizen is hate and fear. When you combine both, that's where you get extremism, right? And if you build hate and fear on lies, that's how it functions. Add to that social media, the megaphone. I mean, everyone is a journalist, everyone is right. It used to be so that a journalist could reach 100,000 people through his newspaper. Now you can reach 10 million people, just you alone. It's your truth that they will see. And that's what you see happening with extremism. So is it an absolute priority? Yes. But I tackle it from the angle of the right to know, the truth, because you have to cut it down from the very bottom. But again, that's a very difficult difficult debate. But I am absolutely agreeing with you that extremism in its broad form is an absolute priority to be tackled, but in any field. I don't know whether that responds to your remarks, dear colleague. Of course, I can go on for hours on this one, and I invite you to Strasbourg, and we can debate some more about it.
I would go because I already have the nostalgia of to participate physically in the meetings. But you answer very well to my questions. I think it's very important that we are very aware about these difficulties that we are having now, and the need to discuss more deeply this last subject concerning the political extremism in our society is linked to social networks and how it disturbs our democracies, I guess so. So thank you very much for your replies.
Thank you, Paulo. No, I completely agree about this kind of the kind of effects these restrictions provoke in the parliamentary work, because parliaments are physical interaction, and as you explained very well, what we see predominantly in the video conferences is the different speeches, sometimes regarding the same questions, but different with different points of view, and there is no interaction. There is not. They don't even try to persuade the other, because there is no room for that. Well, this is a very bad condition to the parliaments. Yeah, yeah. Yes, democracy is that.
pour nous, c'est plus, c'est plus simple. Maintenant, on a approuvé un règlement pour les prochaines semaines et les déplacements à l'étranger, toutes les délégations sont interdites. Donc, il n'y a pas de déplacement. On va revoir ces règles en janvier, donc on espère qu'on peut y aller. Mais c'est très récent, quoi. C'est, il y a 15 jours qu'on a changé les règles. Et les déplacements sont plus possibles pour les délégations dans les institutions. Ils ont prévu certaines exceptions et donc ils peuvent le faire. Pour de ça, hier, dans une audition sur les vaccins et sur les meilleures formes de communiquer, il y a je crois que c'était le représentant de l'OMS qui a présenté une sorte de graphique avec les gens qui sont pour et contre les vaccins. C'était pas cette année, c'était l'année dernière. Et donc, c'était une carte magnifique parce qu'il y avait les pros en haut, les contre en bas. Et au milieu, 80% des gens qui ne savent pas très bien. Et donc, il expliquait qu'un des gros problèmes, c'est que ceux qui sont plus actifs sur les réseaux sociaux sont les contre, avec plus de messages, avec plus d'intensité dans les... Et donc, il disait, par exemple, par rapport à l'approche qu'il faut faire en termes de discuter le bienfait des vaccins, c'était surtout travailler les gens du milieu, les 80%. Alors qu'on perd souvent trop de temps à s'occuper des 4% qui sont clairement contre, Et donc tout ça a déclenché une discussion par rapport à d'autres choses qui est un peu avec cette idée. Disons que la vérité et ce qui n'est pas vrai, ça pose un problème dans tous les domaines. Dans les questions des vaccins, dans la politique, dans l'économie, partout. L'autre message, c'était le message il faut écouter. Il faut jamais, et là c'est un problème. Je sais que c'est au Portugal, c'est un peu partout en Europe. Dans le mouvement des négationnistes, il y a 3-4 camps différents. Il y a des gens qui sont vraiment très radicaux, mais il y a aussi des gens, des médecins. Par exemple, un des chiffres qui ont été présentés hier, qui en Angleterre, il y a 4 sur 10 médecins qui sont contre le vaccin. 4 en Belgique, oui, 4 sur 10. Il y a d'autres pays où il y a 3 sur 5. Alors, tout le monde disait, le pire, c'est de mettre la tête sur terre et ne pas vouloir discuter avec les gens. Parce qu'il y a des questions sur lesquelles les gens demandent des réponses, par exemple. Pourquoi on a réussi à avoir un vaccin en tellement très peu de temps? Donc, ça a été très bien expliqué, parce que pour la première fois, soit l'OMS, soit l'Agence européenne des médicaments ont suivi de très près tout le processus. Donc, ils n'ont pas attendu que le processus soit terminé pour avoir les données, pour valider, etc. Et donc, c'était, je crois que même sur ce plan, l'audition d'hier a été très intéressante pour montrer les problèmes et en même temps les expériences. Et dernièrement, une chose extraordinaire, c'est qu'il disait que si vraiment on n'arrive pas à convaincre les gens à prendre ce vaccin, c'est tout le système de vaccination qui va être mis en cause. Parce que ce n'est pas la même approche. Si celle-ci, elle ne marche pas, donc on va remettre en cause toutes les autres pratiques. Donc c'est vraiment un enjeu très... Il y a plusieurs explications. Une des explications, qui la communication n'a pas été faite depuis le début comme il fallait. Et donc, il y a des soupçons. Et donc, exactement, les gens qui sont en bas contre ont alimenté certains soupçons sur les intérêts des multinationales, sur les procédures qui n'ont été pas remplies comme il fallait. Donc, ils ont trop tard communiqué. Et donc, il y avait une sorte de méfiance qui s'est instauré parce qu'on n'a pas démontré pourquoi, dans ce cas, on peut aller plus vite sans rompre avec les procédures traditionnelles. Non. On a chez nous M. Onko qui est vraiment, qui était très aligné contre les vaccins. Hier, il disait dans le débat, 90% des gens ne sont pas contre les vaccins par principe. Elles ne sont pas parce qu'il y a des réponses que viennent pas, ou des mauvaises réponses, des réponses insuffisantes. Et donc tout ça, ça alimente encore la méfiance et la doute, etc. Par rapport du vaccin, par rapport, par exemple, à cette question de la conservation de la logistique à 70 degrés négatifs, il paraît, pour les spécialistes, ça pose énormément de problèmes parce qu'il paraît, non seulement en termes de logistique, que les éléments qui sont servis à produire le vaccin sont, qui ont d'autres références ou d'autres corrélations avec d'autres choses. Enfin, je ne suis pas capable de vous expliquer techniquement, mais ça alimente certains soupçons. Même chez les professionnels de santé. Donc, là, tout est réduit à ça. Une dernière question avant de voir le président, c'est qu'il y a 5 jeunes Portugais, je ne sais pas si vous avez entendu, qui ont déposé une plainte à la Cour européenne des droits de l'homme à propos du climat. C'était, vous l'avez vu, bon, d'accord. Oui, parce qu'hier, on a aussi fait une audition sur cette question-là avec les jeunes Français. Avec un expert, enfin un jeune qui travaille directement avec Guterres comme conseiller spécial, Et donc, cette question de la génération, et après, on a eu des spécialistes sur le droit international, savoir comment on peut encadrer la question de l'environnement, de la défense intergénérationnelle dans la convention, s'il faut avoir un protocole additionnel, s'il faut faire une autre convention. C'était un débat assez intéressant avec une Française et avec un Canadien qui travaille, qui est professeur, qui travaille pour l'ONU. Sur ce débat, le message qui a été passé, pour moi, c'était, je ne suis pas spécialiste, contrairement à Pedro, dans ces domaines, c'est qu'on a un retard en Europe abyssal par rapport aux autres pays, notamment aux États-Unis et au Canada. Et donc, ça va en contre à ce que vous disiez. Ce n'est pas une question simplement de le mettre, c'est aussi d'attraper le retard.
Non, mais
moi,
tactique aussi.